after they crossed the Jordan River, captain of the host of the Lord, Joshua the fifth chapter, appeared to Joshua. And Joshua asked him a question. This is on bites number 4. Are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no. Rather, I indeed come now as a captain of the host of the Lord. And then there's 2 paragraphs there, comments. Look at the last paragraph, if you have this sheet in front of you, in which it says, beware, assuming that God is on your side. The Israelites thought that once and lost the ark to the Philistines in 1 Samuel 4, which is way down the timeline from where we are now. And then even further down in Acts the 9th chapter, young Saul thought that, assumed that God was on his side, and found himself rebuked by Jesus on the road to Damascus. Being religious, and here's the point that I want to emphasize, and then we'll go on with Joshua. Being religious does not make you right, nor calling yourself a Christian make you faithful. The battle belongs to the Lord, Proverbs 23:31. But who do I belong to? Pretty good point there that sometimes we think, well, I'm a Christian. I'm a member of that church. And I'm all right. But as we quoted from Abraham Lincoln last week, he said something very similar to that. But we need to make sure that we're on the Lord's side. And just because we may be Christians, as it says there, or call yourself a Christian doesn't make you faithful. Anything on either one of those, number 3 or 4 on the same sheet, anything before we go on? We have, way back when, handed out some charts. And this is one I like to refer to because it's kind of sets it up in a, I don't know what kind of thing you want to call it. But it divides the book of Joshua right here down the middle. First 12 chapters over here, the others right over here. And the first column there is the first 5 chapters. We've covered that so far in our class. The second column is conquering the enemy and subjection of the land. First column in that is central campaign, and then the southern campaign. Chapters 6 through 9 here, and chapters 10 through 12 there. We're in chapter 6 right here, and we're going to go and fight the battle of Jericho. This is a very uncluttered map that I didn't give you, but if you can see it here, they're over here. Their starting point was Shittim, and they cross the Jordan River on dry land, and they go to Gilgal to camp out there. This is the Dead Sea. They're just north of the Dead Sea. Jericho, and as I said last week, Gilgal is just either northeast or southeast of Jericho. So Gilgal simply means the grove of thorn bushes. So there must have been some thorn bushes there. There's another, a hawthorn tree, I think is what some people call it. And I guess a hawthorn tree has stickers on it. What's another term? Thorns? That's what I'm saying. Okay, anyway, so they're going to be walking around Jericho, and then they come up to Ai, and then they'll go down here, and then they're going up that way. I thought I'd not take a lot of time, but just mention this. In 1896, they were doing some excavation over on the east side of the Jordan River, over here in this area here. And if you look at Numbers, the 21st chapter, verse 29 and 30, and Joshua, the 13th chapter, verse 8 and 9. I've got them here. I'll just read them right quick. You can Go there if you like. Numbers 21, it says, Woe to you, Moab, you are undone, O people of Chemosh. He has made his sons fugitives and his daughters captives to the Amorite king Sihon. So we overthrew them. Heshbon, as far as Dibon, perished. And we laid waste as far as Naphtah. Fire spread as far as Medeba. If you're following there, that's M-E-D-E-B-A. So keep that in mind. In Joshua, the 13th chapter, when they're going to divide the land again, or divide it between the half-tribe of Manasseh and the Reubenites and the Gadites, Joshua, the 13th chapter, verse 8 and 9, with the other half of the tribe of Manasseh and the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses gave them beyond the Jordan, eastward, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them from Aor, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and the city that is in the middle of the valley, and all the tableland of Medeba, as far as Dibon. In the version I was reading from, as I said, that Medeba is spelled with E's, M-E-D-E-B-A. And as I said, in 1896, they were doing some excavation over here in that area, and they found in ruins of a Byzantine church building some mosaics, millions of little tiles. And that's what this is a picture of here. And I'll tell you what that's saying right there in just a minute. But the tiles or the mosaics on the floor were probably sometime in the 600s A.D. And the one that shows Jerusalem is kind of interesting because it shows what is called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. 600 A.D., you could see what the church, what Jerusalem looked like with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Brian had showed us pictures of that. So Constantine's mother, in about 300 A.D., went around the country building shrines. Church of the Holy Sepulchre was probably built in the 300s. 300 years later, there was a map in these mosaics that shows the city of Jerusalem, what it would have looked like after the destruction in 70 A.D., 600 years later. Anyhow, in this part of the map here, or part of the mosaic here, you can see the word Jericho. And if you can see it well enough, you can see palm trees right here. Jericho is a city of palms. This was a bit of this, as I said, mosaics at 600 A.D., 650, somewhere along there. J-E-R-I-C-H-O, Jericho. So way back then, they had maps. If you like archaeology, I do. That's the reason I told you about it. Any questions? I just thought that might be interesting. The place where these mosaics are found is Medeba, and that's mentioned in those two passages that I read. Spelled different, M-A-B-A-D-A today, but it, back there in the versions I was reading from, it's M-E-D-B-A, so forth. Okay, well, here is... Pardon me?
Did you mention those are...
Yeah, I didn't mention that's in Greek, but that would be Greek letters there. And you can see an E there, but that's an R and an I, and that's a key, which is CH in our English, and that thing that looks like a W is an O. Ted.
I think there must have been some ruins or something about the Diva for them to excavate and find the mosaic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was covered up. The Byzantine church building and everything had been...
So they had an idea, right, pretty much where it was at, so that's where they started digging it.
Well, they knew because of the ruins of the Byzantine church building that there's something significant there. Okay. And so they started uncovering the ruins, and they got down to these floors, which were mosaic, millions of tiles, and they found these maps. In fact,
when did this take place? Do you have any idea? Oh, you said 1890-something?
1896 is when it was discovered by archaeologists. Yeah. 600, 650 AD is when the mosaics were probably built, or manufactured, whatever you call it. It would have been in the, I know you want to know this, it would have been in the second caliph after Muhammad. Muhammad, first caliph, second caliph, which is 650, 600 AD, somewhere in there. And, all right. Did I see another hand? So here is a picture of Jericho. You see the mound here, and that's what a lot of the excavations were, or what you find in the excavation in archaeology is there's a mound, and they start digging in it. And this is probably looking southwest or south northwest, something like that. Anyway, you see palm trees. This here is a drawing of what they think the wall was like when Joshua and the people got there. There were two walls, an inner wall and an outer wall. And the inner wall would be 12 feet here, and then there's earth embankment between the two, 6 feet here, and so on. And so it kind of gives us an idea in this drawing, if you can see it, that here's the outer wall, and then this is the inner wall here. So how could Rahab live on the wall? She would live in this part here. That's an artist drawing, but there was an outer and inner wall, and the walls fell down. They entered up on it and into the city. This is actually a picture, a photograph of some of what you can see in the ruins. This is a tower, probably one of the first skyscrapers built back there in Jericho. It would have been a watchtower, and you can go there today. Did you go there? When I was there, you can look down. You look down into this, and you can see part of the bottom of the tower, the watchtower at Jericho. Ram's horn. Why would I picture a ram's horn? That has anything to do with Joshua? Jericho? I'm sure there were other kind of ram's horns other than that twisted one there, but anyhow. Seven priests. Why did I mention them? God called the people how to take the city. Seven priests had something to do. They had a ram's horn. And the seven priests were to march in the middle of the procession. On this side and on this side of the priest were who? Armed guard. They're the army. Army before and after the Ark of the Covenant and the priest. The priests were to blow their ram's horn continually as they marched around once a day. And of course, on the seventh day, you know what they did. They also had silver trumpets, but the ram's horn was used to call to battle, and the silver trumpets were to celebrate with, so to speak. So, have you ever, I try to picture in my mind, other than the drawings that we have, like this. This is the priest with the seven ram's horn here, and they've marched around, and this is the seventh day because the walls will start falling down. What's that right there? What's that represent? Can you see it? Okay, Rahab's house, and the spies told her, the two men told her to put that scarlet cord out her window. And of course, this is a drawing. We don't know what it really looked like, but so they would know where she was and she'd be safe. But what I started to say was, I tried to picture in my mind, if I was in Jericho, and these people, the army and the priest, walking around the city, not saying a word other than blowing the trumpets or the ram's horn. And I'm standing there on the wall looking down. What in the world is wrong with these people? But it wasn't maybe just wonder like I would have. What was their feeling? How did they feel? Have you read Joshua the sixth chapter? Anybody remember?
It says something about their hearts melted or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I had the passage right here, and then I don't see it for some reason or other. If you see that, the people's heart, as Gail said, the people in Jericho, their heart melted. What does that mean? They were in fear because they've already heard, as Rahab mentioned, they've already heard the conquests that these people have done. But now they just see them around, walking around, 6 days, they walk around, blow the trumps continually as they go around, the ram's horn, and these people are fearful. Question. What kind of weapons did these fellows have that were marching before and after the Ark of the Covenant? You're silent because they don't say they had any weapons, right? The armed men. Mo? Shall we check that out?
Verse 4 says they will carry the ram's horn. And it says in verse 5, verse 4, the priest shall carry 7 ram's horns before the ark. Then on the 7th day, he shall march around the city 7 times, and the priest shall blow the trumpet.
Where did I get the idea that they would blow the trumpets every day and tell us?
I don't know. I thought they had to march around and be quiet. They would be silent when they marched. And then on the 7th day, when the trumpet sounded, then they all shall shout and the walls will come tumbling down.
Well, I think in verse 8 and 9, it was going to happen.
Verse 8. Just as Joshua had commanded, the people, the 7 priests, bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horn before the Lord, went forward, blowing the trumpets with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them. The armed men walking before the priest who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard was walking after the Ark while the trumpets blew continually. Yes, trumpets and the ram's horn, same thing. But Joshua commanded the people, you shall not shout or make your voice heard, and neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout. Then you shall shout. So he caused the ark of the Lord to circle the city, going about it once. They came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Now what do we decide? Then Joshua rose early in the morning. The priest took up the Ark of the Covenant. The 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets, this is verse 13, of ram's horn before the Ark of the Lord walked on. They blew the trumpets continually, and the armed men walked before and after them. The rear guard was walking after the Ark of the Covenant while the trumpets were blew continually. On the second day, they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. So they did for 6 days. What's the conclusion?
They
what? They blew continually every day?
Yes.
Okay.
They didn't shout.
They
didn't
shout. Yeah, right. They didn't shout.
Their voices couldn't be heard.
Right. But on the seventh day, they marched around seven times, and then Joshua, according to God's command, after the seventh time the trumpets blew, they shouted. And one of the questions, I think, on this sheet says, Joshua said, shout for what? Jehovah has given you the city. That was on the seventh day. Lysander.
Okay, but prior to the seventh day, they only marched once, right?
Once around the city, blowing the trumpets, or the ram's horn, yeah. Not very big. If we look at this here, that's a mound. And of course, it could have been bigger than this, but that's what the mound is today. I would say, just a guessing, 300 yards around it. But on this picture here, now, like I say, it could have been bigger than that as far as. It's not, in our way of thinking, cities were not very big. They were jammed in, packed, like the city of Jerusalem. A million people in there. But if you look at the walls of the old city of Jerusalem, it's not very long, far around it. They lived in houses that were packed right next to each other, kind of like the Chinese do today. Did you see that picture of those apartments the other day? Maybe it was Japanese anyway. Ted?
Yeah, I was just wondering, how much power did Jericho have? I mean, like a city-state, or were they a territory, or was it just that city and that was it? Did they have anything?
The cities is where they lived. They would go out to tend their crops. That make sense? There would have been olive yards, olive vineyards, date palms, what else? Their sheep would have been outside the city. Okay. Gail.
Your melted hearts is in chapter 5, verse
1. Okay, I knew it. I looked at first chapter, the first verse of chapter 6, and I didn't find it. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who lived by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. So that's before they started around Jericho. So there's no heart in them. We don't use that term very much, but when the Seahawks or the Mariners lose a game, sometimes they didn't have any heart in them. What do we mean? They weren't ready to play the game. So it was with the people in Jericho. Thanks, Gail. I knew that was in the first verse of one of the chapters, and I didn't look any further. Okay. Let's see. Oh, I was still on. What kind of armor did these fellows have? What kind of weapons? Anybody read lesson 17? The only weapons they are told to use are their feet for marching, their lungs for blowing trumpets, and their voices for shouting. Lysander?
Well, it did mention the armed men. So, oh, okay. So I get it now.
But they didn't use them to destroy the city. They went in after the walls fell, yes. Yeah. The armed men before and after the covenant, yes. But for the falling of the walls, those are the three things that this outline mentions they had for weapons. their feet, their lungs, and their voices were shouting. It mentions here, that next sentence, that they didn't murmur. There wasn't any murmuring among the Israelites who were walking around like the previous generation. And the last sentence in this first paragraph of the outline says, they have learned the lesson of God's benevolent power, respect for his approved leadership, and the importance of obedience. And so they had a test of their faith, and they were triumphant. But I'll get back to that. The first sentence says, while the march around Jericho excites the imagination of young Bible students, and we've got that song, Joshua Fought the Battle of Jericho, the original event must surely have been a test of faith for Israel. You think that's a good statement? Would it have tested their faith? Did it test their faith? Were they faithful in their faith? They were, weren't they? Yes, Kay.
21. After the walls fell down, they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkey, with the edge of the sword.
Mm-hmm.
So they had.
Yes, they had swords, yes. But that's not what they used to make. Yeah, that's what we were getting at. Yes, they were armed men. That's before, as they were marching, they were in front and the rear of the Ark of the Covenant, the priest blowing the ram's horn. Yeah. There's a verse, and I'm not going to take time to look at it. There's a verse that sticks in my mind that there's 40,000 soldiers, but that's not important right now. I need to get on to some other things. You can look up that verse somewhere. The second paragraph is where I want to spend most of our time that's left. The fall of Jericho also clearly illustrates the relationship between faith, works, and grace. God had said, I have given Jericho into your hand, Joshua 6:2, 6:16. It was a gift which Israel neither deserved nor earned. However, this gift conditioned upon their obedience, specific to the instructions were given, if followed, would cause the walls to fall down. I've already answered the question that I was going to ask. Did they earn the victory? Mo.
They did in effect as they obeyed what God told them to do. They didn't do anything more than what he asked them to do or anything less. So their obedience to those commands are probably saying.
So the same is true with us today. When we obey God, we earn our salvation.
No.
It's not parallel? Ken?
They couldn't have said that they did it because they didn't. And so it wasn't what they did in response to what God asked them to do. He did it because they were obedient.
Well?
Mary?
Well, I suppose
Yeah, skeptics try to say that, you know, it's a myth that this story is. And as Mary said, they'll say, well, there was an earthquake and the walls fell down. I think what I'm trying to get at here in asking the question, did they earn their victory? We have, I think, a misunderstanding about grace and faith. Carm?
I don't want to cut you off.
No, I'll come back to it if I can.
Just like verse 2 of Joshua 6 says that Jericho was given by God into the hands of Israel. So, you know, salvation is a gift of God. It doesn't mean that they earned it or that we earned salvation. But they could have rejected God's gift as we could reject God's gift of salvation. Yeah. So it's not a matter, I don't think, of earning it. It's whether we, through faith, trust, receive that gift or whether we reject that gift.
Everyone hear what Carm said? Our salvation and their victory is by grace. But when the people acted upon their faith, God gave them the city. Is that similar to our salvation? I'm asking a question, and I'm not necessarily asking for an answer right now, but Creamer? No, I'm...
They were saved by faith. In the same way, we are saved by faith. And I think sometimes we have a hard time with this because we want to look at faith as a separate thing from grace, or even that as a separate thing from works. We get into trouble, I think, if we start parsing these things out as separate things. The scripture is very clear. Without faith, you can't please Him. It doesn't matter what you do. So we don't earn anything. We achieve it through faith. And what we do with that faith, God has put conditions there, and we meet those conditions by faith, just like they did, that He gives us the victory.
Salvation is by faith and our obedience, so it's not by grace. I'm not talking what Creamer said there. He made a good point. But what I'm getting at is that we forget that salvation, the victory here, is by grace of God. God gave it to them when they had faith, trusted Him. Lysander?
I almost forgot my...
I'm sorry. And that's what, and I'm not necessarily commenting on what comments have been made, but I'm trying to put it before us here. When those conditions were met, did they earn it? No. Somebody's already pointed that out. But it's by faith. Grace by faith. The gift by faith. If you don't trust God, you're not going to walk around the walls. Ken?
I think it comes down to works of righteousness. Paul points to Abraham to illustrate that perfectly. That he didn't earn what God promised him. Faithful in believing God and following through with his belief in works that save.
Ephesians, the second chapter. Grace by faith, works, works of righteousness. Whose works are they? God's the one that said, walk around the wall. I don't know what else to ask the question I'm thinking of that'll make it any clearer. Brian?
If I was writing the second paragraph, first sentence I would have said, the fall of Jericho also clearly illustrates the relationship between faith and grace. I'd leave out the word works. And then in the middle of the paragraph, however, this gift was conditioned upon there, and I would put the word faith in there. Faith isn't faith if it doesn't have obedience. Faith isn't faith if it isn't working. But the power that brought the walls down was God's power. And they had to trust in that because faith demands the unreasonable, and it was totally unreasonable to march around the city like that. You look like dumb ducks. You know, quack, quack, quack. It was totally unreasonable. So did they trust in God? They sure did, because they looked stupid doing it, but it was his power that brought it down, and they trusted in him.
I'll come back to that, Gail.
Okay, just to kind of simplify it, obedience and any actions that the humans do is what we do. The grace that God gives is what he does.
Yes and no, and what Brian was saying here is the emphasis.
It is a yes and no.
And I'd agree with what Brian said, that the first sentence there, the relationship between faith and grace, leave out the word works. We don't earn our salvation. The word works sounds like we do. And that's and I know that what he's saying here. But the second, third sentence, however, this gift conditioned upon their faith. If they didn't have faith, they wouldn't obey. And so the emphasis is upon faith. But you've got to understand what faith is.
Right.
It's trust to do something that is unreasonable, as Brian pointed out. Now, when you have that trust and you do the unreasonable, God gives you the salvation or the victory. But what I'm saying is, I think, and Brian has pointed it out before, I think, what we're saying is that so many times we are emphasizing obedience, obedience, obedience. And I know that you're going to understand that it's because of faith that a person will do what he does if he trusts in God. So I would agree with Brian here, and you don't have to agree with either one of us, that the wording of this is what kind of bothered me, Jericho fell clearly illustrates the relationship between faith and grace. The works, the action will be there if the faith is what it ought to be. Somebody out. Go ahead, Ken.
In Romans, the fourth chapter, starting with verse 1, what then shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, has found according to the flesh? He's making a contrast then between flesh and the spirit. For if Abraham was justified by works, he hath whereof to glory, but not toward God. Well, what saith the scripture? And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned unto him for righteousness. Now to him that worketh, the reward is not reckoned as of grace, but as debt. But to him that worketh not, but believeth on him that justifieth the ungodly, his faith is reckoned for righteousness. Even as David also pronounced blessing upon the man unto whom God reckoneth righteousness apart from works, saying, blessed are they whose iniquities are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not reckon sin.
Abraham is an excellent example.
Amen.
He was told to go and offer his son as a sacrifice. That's unreasonable in our minds. May have been in Abraham's, but it wasn't, because he had faith. Abraham's faith caused him to do what was unreasonable. And we could go to Hebrews 11th chapter and other places. But anyway, I didn't need to emphasize this with you today, but I have seen so many times, as this fellow here, whoever wrote this, I think overemphasizes works. And to me, that has given us the idea that if we will work, 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 obey, 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 we'll be saved. Is following the instruction of God by faith the means to obtain the grace of God?
Yeah.
Terry?
I like the old illustration I heard here years ago. And I think of our salvation now under what Jesus called, more in line with this. But if I come up to you and I say, I'm going to give you $100. You don't know why. I don't have any reason. So I give you
That's one illustration I've heard. You've heard, and tell me whether or not this is a good illustration. You've heard about the fellow out drowning in the water, and somebody throws a life raft to him, one of those rings, you know. Is he going to be saved from drowning because he believes that good fellow? He's got to grab a hold of it. The person who threw that out there and he grabs onto it, save that fellow by grace. And he was saved by his faith. Because he did what was necessary to express that faith. Okay? We're saved by grace through faith. Kay's reading Ephesians 4, about verse 8 and 9. 2, rather. About, always get that mixed up. 2, verse 8 and 9. We're saved by grace through faith. It's a gift of God. And then there are certain things that we walk in faith. That last verse. Ted, and our time's almost gone. Love and faith are action words. It's not love unless you act. It's not faith unless you act. But when it's all said and done, God gave them the city. And God gives us salvation. We don't earn it. End of sermon. Let's go. Thanks. We'll continue with lesson 17 next week.